This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Audio Journal. Material is selected with the interest of its audience in mind and with the goal to inform and entertain. The opinions expressed on this program do not reflect the views and opinions of Audio Journal, its board of directors, staff, or volunteer readers. Welcome to Extraordinary Tales, a production of Audio Journal, bringing you fiction and nonfiction short stories. Today, Extraordinary Tales brings you an hour of short stories, originally aired on North Texas Radio of the Blind in Dallas. Enjoy.
Welcome back to an hour of short stories. I'm your host and narrator, John Pritchett. Today's short stories come from two little-known authors, Anthony Wynn of Scotland and Tim Pritkin, who was born in North Carolina. Anthony Wynn is the pseudonym of Robert McNair Wilson, a medical doctor who qualified at Glasgow University. An author of science-based detective fiction, he created the highly observant Dr. Eustace Haley, who specialized in psychiatry and mental disorders. Dr. Haley, who takes snuff to stay awake, uses inductive reasoning to catch criminals. He is assisted by Lieutenant Biles, a personal friend and police inspector. The following story, The Cyprian Bees, begins with a bit of Poison Science by Raymond T. Bond. An unusual and far-reaching scientific discovery in the field of poisons is associated with the name of the celebrated French physicist and Nobel Prize winner Charles Roget. Aboard the yacht of the Prince of Monaco, Roget was studying the poisonous marine life of the Indian Ocean, particularly the Portuguese man-of-war. Unable to complete his researches toward an immunization formula during the voyage, Roget returned to France and substituted the poisonous nettle for the man-of-war. There he began his systematic injections of the nettle poison, using dogs in his laboratory tests. In completing a second round of injections, Roget noticed that one of his animals was acting strangely. Although this second injection had been relatively weak, the dog began to retch and vomit, then to drag his hind legs in a pitiful gesture of distress. As Roget looked on, the dog fell on its side and died. What had begun as a hopeful attempt to immunize the animal had ended with the opposite result. When several other instances of the same contradictory result followed, Roget devoted all his attentions to this strange reaction, by which a substance, poisonous but not harmless on the first injection, became highly dangerous and often fatal when administered a second time in the same or lesser doses. Roget believed that the first injection destroyed the body's resistance to the poison, so that it was completely vulnerable to a second dosage, even if this were much weaker. He called the phenomenon anaphylaxis, without protection, in contradistinction to the prophylaxis, or the favoring protection which he had tried to achieve. The discovery was not so important in itself as for the interest it aroused in earlier experiments, such as those conducted in 1839 by Magendie, into the poisonous properties of the white of the egg. Here, too, the dogs died suddenly on the second injection. Further experiments showed that the same reactions could be obtained, even when the injected substances were completely non-poisonous. Often these substances were animal sera, and the laboratory experiments thus foreshadowed the occasional human deaths in multiple antitoxin injections. Out of the study of this entire phenomenon stemmed to no small degree the highly important progress made in the treatment of allergy, itself a form of self-poisoning, and a physical reaction which is parallel to, but not identical with, the process of immunization. Detective story writers have approached, but by no means entered into the sudden subtleties of death by anaphylaxis and allergy. Here begins The Cyprian Bees. Inspector Biles of Scotland Yard placed a small wooden box on the table in front of Dr. Haley. "There," he remarked in cheerful tones, "is a mystery which even you, my dear doctor, will scarcely be able to solve." Dr. Haley bent his great head and examined the box with minute care. It was merely a hollowed-out block of wood, to which a lid, also of wood, was attached at one point by a nail. The lid rotated on this nail. He put out his hand to open it, but Biles checked that intention immediately. "Take care," he exclaimed. There are 3 live bees in that box, he added. There were 4 of them originally, but one stung a colleague of mine who was incautious enough to pull the lid open without first finding out what it covered. He leaned back in his chair and drew a long whiff of the excellent cigar which Dr. Haley had supplied him. He remained silent while a heavy vehicle went lumbering down Harley Street. Then he said, Last night one of my men found the box lying in the gutter in Piccadilly Circle, just opposite the Criterion Theater. He thought it looked peculiar and brought it down to the yard. We have a beekeeper of some distinction on the strength, and he declares that these insects are all workers, and only a lunatic would carry them about in this fashion. Queens, it appears, are often transported in boxes. Dr. Haley raised his eyeglass and set it in his eye. So I have heard. He opened his snuff-box and took a large pinch. You know, of course, my dear Biles, he added, what this particular box contained before the bees were put into it? No, I don't. Serum, either anti-diphtheria serum or one of the other varieties. Practically every manufacturer of these products uses this type of receptacle for them. Biles leaned forward in his chair. So that means, in all probability, the owner of the bees is a doctor. How very interesting. Dr. Haley shook his head. It doesn't follow, he remarked. The box was perhaps left in a patient's house after its contents had been used. The patient may have employed it for its present purpose. Biles nodded. He appeared to hesitate a moment. Then he said, The reason why I troubled you was that last night a woman was found dead at the wheel of a motor car, a closed coupe in Leicester Square. She had been stung by a bee just before her death. He spoke in quiet tones, but his voice nevertheless revealed the fact that the disclosure he was making had assumed great importance in his mind. He added, The body was examined by a doctor almost immediately. He observed the sting, which was on her forehead. The dead bee was recovered later from the floor of the car. As he spoke, he took another box from his pocket and opened it. He held it out to the doctor. You will notice that there are rather unusual markings on the bee's body, these yellow rings. Our experts say that they indicate a special breed, the Cyprian, and that these insects are notoriously very ill-natured. The peculiar thing is that the bees in the wooden box are also Cyprian bees. Dr. Haley picked up a large magnifying glass which lay on the table beside him and focused it on the body of the insect. His knowledge of bees was not extensive, but he recognized that this was not the ordinary brown English type. He set the glass down and leaned back in his chair. It is certainly very extraordinary, he declared. Have you any theory? Biles shook his head. None, beyond the supposition that the shock caused by the sting was probably the occasion for the woman's sudden collapse. She was seen to pull quickly to the side of the road and stop the car, so she must have had a presentiment of what was coming. I suppose heart failure might be induced by a sting? It is just possible. Dr. Haley took more snuff. Once long ago, he said, I had personal experience of a rather similar case, that of a beekeeper who was stung some years after he had given up his own apiary. He died in about 5 minutes, but that was a clear case of anaphylaxis. I don't understand. Dr. Haley thought a moment. Anaphylaxis, he explained, is the name given to one of the most amazing phenomena in the whole of medical science. If a human being receives an injection of serum or blood or any extract or fluid from the animal body, a tremendous sensitiveness is developed afterwards towards that particular substance. For example, an injection of the white of a duck's egg will, after the lapse of a week or so, render a man so intensely sensitive to this particular egg white that, if a further injection is given, instant death may result. Even if a duck's egg is eaten, there may be a violent sickness and collapse, though hen's eggs will cause no ill effect. Queerly enough, however, if the injection is repeated within, say, a day of its first administration, no trouble occurs. For the sensitiveness to develop, it is essential that time should elapse between the first injection and the second one. Once the sensitiveness has developed, it remains active for years. The beekeeper, whose death I happened to witness, had often been stung before, but he had not been stung for a very long time. Good God! Biles' face wore an expression of new interest. So it's possible that this may actually be a case of murder? He pronounced the words in tones of awe. Dr. Haley saw that already his instincts as a manhunter were quickening. It is just possible. But do not forget, my dear Biles, that the murderer using this method would require to give his victim a preliminary dose, by inoculation, of bee poison, because a single sting would scarcely be enough to produce the necessary degree of sensitiveness. That is to say, he would require to exercise an amount of force which would inevitably defeat his purpose, unless he happened to be a doctor. Ah, the wooden serum box! The detective's voice thrilled. Possibly. A doctor undoubtedly could inject bee poison, supposing he possessed it, instead of ordinary serum, or of an ordinary vaccine. It would hurt a great deal, but patients expect inoculation to hurt them. Biles rose. There is no test, is there, he asked, by which it would be possible to detect the presence of the sensitiveness you speak of in a dead body? None. So we can only proceed by means of circumstantial evidence. He drew a sharp breath. The woman had been identified as the widow of an artist named Bardwell. She had a flat, a luxurious one in Park Mansions, and seemed to have been well off. He glanced at his watch. I'm going there now. I suppose I couldn't persuade you to accompany me? Dr. Haley's rather listless eyes brightened. For answer he rose, towering above the detective in that act. My dear Biles, you know that you can always persuade me. The flat in Park Mansions was rather more and yet rather less than luxurious. It bespoke prodigality, but it bespoke also restlessness of mind, as though its owner had felt insecure in her enjoyment of its comforts, and their contents were saved from vulgarity only by sheer carelessness of their bestowal. This woman seemed to have bought anything and to have cared for nothing. Thus in her dining-room an exquisite Queen Anne sideboard was set cheek by jowl with the most horrible Victorian armchair made of imitation walnut. In the drawing-room there were flower glasses of the noblest period of Venetian craftsmanship, in which beauty was held captive in wonderful strands of gold, and beside these, shocking and obscene examples of golden glassware from some third-rate Bohemian factory. Dr. Haley began to form a mental picture of the dead woman. He saw her, changeable, greedy, gaudy, yet with a certain instinctive charm, the kind of woman who, if she is young and beautiful, gobbles up a man. Women of that sort, his experiences had shown him, were apt to drive their lovers to despair with their extravagances or their infidelities. Had the owner of the bees embarked on this terrible course in order to secure himself against the mortification of being supplanted by some more attractive rival, or was he merely removing from his path a woman of whom he had grown tired? In any case, if the murder theory was correct, he must have stood in the relationship to the dead girl of doctor to patient, and he must have possessed an apiary of his own. A young detective whom Biles introduced as Tadcaster had already made a careful examination of the flat. He had found nothing, not even a photograph, nor had the owners of neighboring flats been able to supply any useful information. Mrs. Bardwell, it appeared, had had men friends who had usually come to see her after dark. They had not, apparently, been in the habit of writing to her, for if they had, she had destroyed all their letters. During the last few weeks she seemed to have been without a servant. "So you have found nothing?" Biles' tones were full of disappointment. "Nothing, sir. Unless, indeed, this is of any importance." Tadcaster held out a single crumpled piece of paper. It was a shop receipt, bearing the name of the Times Book Club, for a copy of the Love Songs of Robert Browning. There was no name on it. Biles handed it to Dr. Haley, who regarded it for a few moments in silence, and then asked, "Where did you find this?" "In the fireplace of the bedroom." The doctor's eyes narrowed. "It does strike me," he said, "that such a collection of poems would not be likely to interest the owner of this flat." He folded the slip and carefully put it into his pocketbook. He added, "On the other hand, Browning's love songs do appeal very strongly to some women." He fixed his eyeglass and regarded the young detective. "Have you not found the book itself, have you?"
"No, sir. There are a few novels in the bedroom, but no poetry of any kind."
Dr. Haley nodded. He asked to be shown the collection and made a detailed examination of it. The novels were all of the lurid sex type. It was as he had anticipated. He opened each of the books and glanced at the fly-leaves. They were all blanks. He turned to Biles.
"I am ready to bet that Mrs. Bardwell did not pay that bill at the book club," he declared. "And I am ready to bet also that this book was not bought for her."
The detective shrugged his shoulders.
"Probably not," he said unconcernedly.
"Then why should the receipt for it be lying in this room?"
"My dear doctor, how should I know? I suppose because the man who possessed it chose to throw it away here."
The doctor shook his head.
"Men do not buy collections of love songs for themselves, nor for that matter do women. They buy them, almost invariably, to give to people they are interested in.
Everybody, I think, recognizes that."
He broke off. A look of impatience came into Byles' face.
"Well, therefore, a man does not, as a rule, reveal to one woman the fact that he has made a purchase on behalf of another. I mean, it is difficult to believe that any man on intimate terms with Mrs. Bardwell would have invited her jealousy by leaving such plain evidence of his interest in another woman lying about in her rooms. I assume, you see, that no man would give this poor lady this particular book."
Byles shrugged his shoulders. The point seemed to him immaterial. He glanced around the bedroom with troubled eyes.
"I wish," he declared, "that we had something to go on, something definite leading towards some individual."
His words were addressed impartially to his subordinate and to Dr. Haley. The former looked blank, but the doctor's expression was most eager. He raised his eyeglass and put it into his eye.
"My dear Byles," he said, "we have something definite to go on. I was about to suggest to you, when you interrupted me, that the receipt for the book probably fell from the pocket of the purchaser through a hole in that pocket, just as the little box containing the additional bees, which he had not found it necessary to release, was destined to fall later, when the man, having assured himself that an instinct of unimpaired vigor was loose and on the wing, descended into Piccadilly Circus from Mrs. Bardwell's car."
He paused. The detective had turned to him, interested once more. The thought crossed Dr. Haley's mind that it was a pity Byles had not been gifted by Providence with an appreciation of human nature as keen as his grasp of material circumstances. He allowed his eyeglass to drop in a manner which proclaimed that he had shot his bolt. He asked,
"You have not, perhaps, taken occasion to watch a man receiving a shop receipt for goods he just bought and paid for? Believe me, a spectacle full of instruction in human nature. The receipt is handed, as a rule, by a girl, and the man, as a rule, pushes it into his nearest pocket, because he does not desire to be so rude or so untidy as to drop it on the floor. Shyness, politeness, and tidiness, my dear Byles, are all prominent elements in our racial character." Again he broke off, this time to take a pinch of snuff.
The two detectives watched that process with some impatience.
"A man with a hole in his coat pocket, a hole not very large, yet large enough to allow a piece of crumpled paper to work its way out, as the wearer of the coat strode up and down the floor of the room. Is not that a clue? A doctor, perhaps, with deep in his soul the desire for such women as Mrs. Bardwell? Cheap, yet attractive women."
"I thought you expressed the opinion that he bought the love songs for some other woman," Byles snapped.
"Exactly. Some other woman sufficiently like Mrs. Bardwell to attract him, though evidently possessed of a veneer of education to which Mrs. Bardwell could lay no claim."
Dr. Haley's large, kindly face grew thoughtful.
"Has it not struck you," he asked, "that though a man may not be faithful to any one woman, he is almost always faithful to a type? Again and again I have seen in first and second wives the same qualities of mind and appearance, both good and bad. Indeed, I would go so far as to say that our first loves and our last are kindred spirits, recognized and chosen by needs and desires which do not change, or change but little, throughout the course of life."
"Even so, my dear Haley." Byles' looks of perplexity had deepened. The doctor, however, was too eager to be discouraged.
"If Mrs. Bardwell was in fact murdered," he continued, "the figure of her murderer is not, I think, very difficult to visualize. A doctor in early middle life, because the dead woman is at least 30, with the practice in the country, but the taste of a townsman.
a trifle careless of his clothes, since he tolerates holes in his pockets, a sentimental egotist, since he buys Browning's love songs while plans of murder are turning over in his mind. He broke off and thought a moment. It is probable that Mrs. Bardwell was an expensive luxury. Such women, too, fight like tigers for the possession of the men they rely on. Yet though she had undoubtedly obtained a great, perhaps a terrible hold on him, she had failed to make him marry her. He turned to Byles and readjusted his eyeglass. "Why do you suppose," he asked, "Mrs. Bardwell failed to make this doctor marry her?" "I have no idea." The detective's tones were crisp, almost to the point of abruptness. Dr. Haley moved across the room to a writing table which stood near the window. He took a sheet of paper and marked a circle on it. Around this he drew a much larger circle. He returned to the detectives who stood watching him. "Here is London," he said, pointing to the small circle, "and here is the country round it, up to a distance of 40 miles. That is to say, up to a two-hour journey by motor car. As our doctor seems to make frequent visits to town, that is not, I think, too narrow a radius. Beyond 40 miles, London is no longer within easy reach." He struck his pencil through two places through the circumference of a larger circle, marking off a segment. "Here," he went on, "are the Surrey Highlands, the area within our district where heather grows, and where, in consequence, almost everyone keeps bees." He raised his head and faced the two men, whose interest he seemed to have recaptured. "It should not," he suggested, "be impossible to discover whether or not, within this area, there is a doctor in practice who keeps Cyprian bees, is constantly running to London, wears an overcoat with a hole in one of his pockets, and lives apart from his wife." "Good heavens!" Byles drew his breath sharply. His instincts as a manhunter had reasserted themselves. He glanced at the doctor with enthusiasm which lacked nothing of generosity. The younger detective, however, retained his somewhat critical expression. "Why should a doctor be living apart from his wife?" he asked. "Because, had she not left him as soon as he tired of her, he would probably have killed her long ago. And in that case, he would almost certainly have married Mrs. Bardwell during the first flush of his devotion to her. I know these sensualists, who are also puffed up with literary vanity. Marriage possesses for them an almost incredible attractiveness." He glanced at his watch as he spoke. The recollection of a professional appointment had come suddenly to his memory. "If you are to follow up the clue, my dear Byles," he remarked as he left the flat, "I hope you will let me know the result. The medical directory should serve as a useful starting point." Dr. Haley was kept fully occupied during the next day, and was unable, in consequence, to pursue the mystery of the Cyprian bees any further. In the later afternoon, however, he rang up Inspector Byles at Scotland Yard. A voice, the tones of which were sufficiently dispirited, informed him the whole of the home counties did not contain a doctor answering the description with which he had furnished the police. "Mrs. Bardwell," Byles added, "kept a maid who has been on holiday. She returned last night and has now told us that her mistress received very few men at her flat, and that a doctor was not among the number. Of course, it is possible that a doctor may have called during the last fortnight, in the girl's absence. But in the circumstances, I am afraid we must look on the murder theory as rather far-fetched. After all, the dead woman possessed a car, and may have been in the country herself on the morning on which she was stung. Bees often get trapped in cars." Dr. Haley hung up the receiver and took a pinch of snuff. He sat down in his big armchair and closed his eyes, that he might pass in fresh review the various scraps of evidence he had collected. If the dead woman had not received the doctor at her house, then the idea that they were on intimate terms could scarcely be maintained. In that case, the whole of his deductions must be invalidated. He got up and walked down Harley Street to the Times Book Club. He showed the receipt which he had retained, and asked if he might see the assistant who had conducted the sale. This girl remembered the incident clearly. It had occurred about a week earlier. The man who had bought the volume of poems was accompanied by a young woman. "Did you happen to notice," Dr. Haley said, "what his companion looked like?"
"I think she was very much made up. She had fair hair, but I can't say that I noticed her carefully."
"And the man?"
The girl shrugged her shoulders.
"I'm afraid I don't remember him clearly. A businessman, perhaps?"
She thought a moment.
"He was a good deal older than she was, I should say."
Dr. Haley left the shop and walked towards Harley Street. On one point, at least, he had not been mistaken. The purchaser of the love songs was a man, and he had bought them for a woman who was not Mrs. Bardwell. Biles had mentioned that this lady had auburn hair. Why should the man have visited Mrs. Bardwell so soon after making this purchase? He sighed. After all, why not? Biles was quite right in thinking that no jury in the world would listen to evidence on the basis of which was character reading at second hand. He reached his door and was about to let himself into the house when a cab drew up beside him. The young detective Tadcaster, to whom Biles had introduced him at Park Mansions, got out. "Can I see you a moment, doctor?" he asked. They entered the house together. Tadcaster produced a letter from his pocket and handed it to Dr. Haley. It was a prescription written on Mrs. Bardwell's notepaper and signed only with initials, which were nearly indecipherable. "I found it after you had gone," the young man explained. "It was dispensed, as you can see, by a local chemist. Today I have seen him, and he says he has had other similar prescriptions to dispense. But he has no idea who the writer is. Mrs. Bardwell had the medicine a few days ago." Dr. Haley read the prescription, which was a simple iron tonic. The signature was illegible. He shook his head.
"This does not carry us much further, I'm afraid."
"You can't tell the initials who the doctor is."
"No. In that case, I think we shall have to throw our hands in."
Tadcaster's voice expressed considerable disappointment. It was obvious that he had hoped to make reputation out of the solution of the mystery.
"Your reasoning yesterday," he added, "impressed me very much, sir, if I may say so."
Dr. Haley inclined his head, but his eyes were vacant. So a doctor had called on the dead woman recently, and also apparently made earlier visits, a doctor, too, whose prescriptions were unfamiliar to the local chemist. He turned to the young detective.
"I have just heard from Biles," he said, "that the maid has come back. Do you happen to know if she has any recollection of these professional visits?"
"I asked her that myself. She says that she knows nothing about them."
Again the faraway look came into the doctor's eyes. The fact that the prescriptions were written on Mrs. Bardwell's notepaper showed that they had been given during an attendance at the flat. For what reason had the dead woman been at pains to hide her doctor's visits from her maid?
"Should I be troubling you very much," he said, "if I ask you to take me back to Park Mansions? I confess I would like to ask that girl a few questions. A doctor can obtain information which is not likely to be imparted to any layman."
As they drove through the crowded streets, Dr. Haley asked himself again the question which had caused him to embark on this fresh investigation. What reason had Mrs. Bardwell for hiding her need of medical attendance from her maid? Even supposing that her doctor was also her lover, there seemed to be no sense in such a concealment. He opened his eyes and saw the stream of London's home-going population surging around the cab. Sweet-faced girls and splendid youths, mingled with women whose eyes told the story of disappointment, and men who wore pressing responsibility as an habitual expression. No wonder the police despaired of finding any one nameless human being in this vast tide of humanity, of hopes and fears, of desires and purposes. The cab stopped. They entered the lift and came to the door of the flat. Tadcaster rang the bell. A moment later, the door was opened by a young girl who invited them to enter in tones which scarcely disguised the anxiety she apparently felt at the return of the police. She closed the door and then led the way along the dim entrance corridor. She opened the door of the drawing room. As the light from the windows fell on her face, Dr. Haley repressed an exclamation of amazement. He started as though a new idea had sprung into his mind. A slight flush mounted to his cheeks. He raised his eyeglass and inserted it quickly in his eye.
"I have troubled you," he said to the girl, "because there are a few points about Mrs. Bardwell's health before her fatal seizure which I think you can help us to understand. I may say that I am a doctor assisting the police."
"Oh, yes."
The girl's voice was low. Her pretty, heavily powdered face seemed drawn with anxiety, and her eyes moved restlessly from one man to the other. She raised her hand in a gesture of uneasiness and clasped her brow, seeming to press her golden curls into the white flesh.
"Perhaps it might be better if I spoke to you alone."
Dr. Haley's tones were very gentle. He looked at Tadcaster as he spoke, and the detective immediately got up and left the room. Then he turned to the girl.
"Your mistress?" he asked.
discharged you from her employment a fortnight ago?" The girl started violently, and all the blood seemed to ebb from her cheeks. Wild fear stared at him from her big, lustrous eyes.
"No! My dear girl, if I may say so, you have everything to gain, nothing to lose by telling the truth."
He spoke coldly, yet there was a reassuring note in his voice. He saw fear give place a little to that quality of weakness which he had expected to find in her character, the quality which had attracted Mrs. Bardwell's lover, and which explained, in some subtle fashion, the gift of the love songs. He repeated his question. The girl hung her head. She consented. He let his eyeglass fall.
"Because of your intimacy with a man she had accustomed to look on as her own particular friend." "Oh, no, no, it is not true."
Again her eyes challenged him. She had thrown back her head, revealing the full roundness of her throat. The light gleamed among her curls. No wonder that this beauty had been able to dispossess her mistress.
"Listen to me."
Dr. Haley's face had grown stern.
"You have denied that any doctor came into this flat, at least so far as you know. As it happens, however, a number of prescriptions were dispensed from Mrs. Bardwell by the local chemist, so that either she took great pains to hide from you the fact that she was calling in a doctor, or you have not been speaking the truth."
"She did not tell me."
He raised his hand.
"It would be easy," he said, "to get an answer to that question. If your mistress was really hiding her doctor's visits from you, she must have taken her prescriptions herself, personally, to the chemist. I shall find out from him later on whether or not that is so."
Again the girl's mood changed. She began to whimper, pressing a tiny lace handkerchief to her eyes in coquettish fashion. Dr. Haley drew a deep breath. He waited a moment before framing his next remark.
Then he said, "You realize, I suppose, that if a girl helps a man to commit a crime, she is as guilty as he is in the eyes of the law?"
"What do you mean?"
All her defenses were now abandoned. She stood before him, abject in her terror, with staring eyes and trembling lips.
"That your presence here today proves you have had a share in this business. Why did you return to this flat?"
Because
he, the man you are shielding, wanted to find out what the police were doing in this place."
She tottered towards him and laid her hands on his arm.
"Oh, God, I am so frightened," she whispered. "You have no reason to be frightened."
He led her to a chair, but suddenly she seemed to get her strength anew. Her grasp on his arm tightened.
"I didn't want to do it," she cried in tones of anguish. "I swear that I didn't. And I swear that I have no idea, even yet, what he did so. We were going to be married immediately."
"Married?"
His voice seemed to underline the word.
"I swear that. I was honest and above board, only he had her on his hands, and she had wasted so much of his money."
For the first time her voice rang true. She added,
"His wife cost a lot, too, though she was not living with him. She died a month ago."
They stood facing one another. In the silence of the room, the ticking of an ornate little clock on the mantelshelf was distinctly audible.
"His name?"
he asked.
"No, I shall not tell you."
She had recaptured her feeble courage. It gleamed from her eyes, for an instant transforming even her weakness, the vague knowledge that she loved this man in her paltry, immoral way came to him. He was about to repeat his demand when the door of the room opened. Tadcaster came in with a small, leather-bound volume in his hand. The girl uttered a shrill cry and sprang towards him, but Dr. Haley anticipated that move. He held her firmly.
"It is the collection of Browning's love songs," the detective said. "I found it lying open in the next room. There is an inscription signed Michael Cornwall."
He held the book out for the doctor's inspection. But Dr. Haley's face had grown as pale, almost as that of the girl by his side. He repeated the name, "Michael Cornwall," almost like a man in a dream. The place was hidden among the trees. Dr. Haley walked up the avenue with slow steps. He thought of the mission which had brought him to this lovely Hampstead house lay, as it had lain through all the hours of the night, like death on his spirits.
Michael Cornwall, the well-known Wimpole Street bacteriologist, and he had been boys together at Uppingham. They were still acquaintances. He came to the front door and was about to ring the bell when the man he was looking for appeared round the side of the house, accompanied by an old man and a girl.
"Haley, well, I am dashed."
Dr. Cornwall advanced with outstretched hand. His deep, rather sinister eyes welcomed his colleague with an enthusiasm which was entirely unaffected. He introduced,
"My uncle, Colonel Cornwall, and his cousin, Miss Patsy Cornwall, whom you must congratulate on having just become engaged,"
in his quick, staccato manner. "We're just going around the garden," he explained,
"and you must accompany us, and after that to luncheon, whereupon, my dear Haley, if you have, as I feel you have, great business to discuss with me, we shall discuss it."
His bantering tones accorded well with his appearance, which had changed but little in the years. He was the same astute, moody, inordinately vain fellow who had earned for himself once upon a time the nickname of the Lynx. They strolled across the lawn and came to a brick wall of that rich russet hue which only time and the season can provide. Dr. Cornwall opened a door in the wall and stood back for his companions to enter. A sight of entrancing beauty greeted them, lines of fruit trees in full blossom, as though the snows of some alpine sunset had been spread in all their glowing tints on this English garden. Dr. Haley, however, had no eyes for this loveliness. His gaze was fixed on a row of white-painted beehives, which gleamed in the sunlight under the distant wall. Patsy Cornwall exclaimed in sheer wonder. Then a new cry of delight escaped her, as she detected, in a large greenhouse which flanked the wall, a magnificent display of scarlet tulips. She took Dr. Haley, in whose eyes the melancholy expression seemed to have deepened, to inspect these, while her father and cousin strolled on up the garden path. She stood with him in the narrow gangway of the greenhouse, and feasted ecstatic eyes on the wonderful blossoms.
"Don't they make you wish to gather them all and take them away somewhere where there are no flowers?"
She turned to him, but he had sprung away from her side.
A cry, shrill and terrible, pierced the lazy silence of the morning. She saw her father and cousin fleeing back, pursued by an immense swarm of winged insects, towards the garden gate.
Blindly, frantically, they sought to ward off the dreadful onslaught. The old man stumbled and would have fallen had not his nephew caught him in his arms. She had a momentary glimpse of his face. It was as though she looked on the face of death.
"The bees!"
The words broke from Dr. Haley's lips as a moan of despair. He had come to the closed door of the greenhouse and seemed to be about to open it, but at the same moment one of the infuriated insects in delirious flight struck the glass pane beside him. Then another, and another, and another.
He came reeling back towards the girl.
"Lie down on the gangway!" he shouted at the highest pitch of his voice. "There may be broken pane somewhere."
She turned her horror-stricken eyes to him.
"My father! Oh, God!" "Lie down for your life."
He stood beside her, watching, ready to strike if one of the bees succeeded in entering the greenhouse. Only once did he remove his straining eyes from this task. The sight which then greeted them wrought a fresh horror in his lips. The terrible swarm hung like a dust cloud in the air above the garden gate, rising and falling in swift undulations, which caused the light to flash and scintillate on a myriad gilded bodies and shining wings. A faint, shrill piping came to his ears across the silence. The door in the wall was open, and the garden now quite empty.
Biles leaned forward.
"Mrs. Bardwell's maid has confessed that she rang up Dr. Cornwall immediately before luncheon this morning," he said. "She tried to communicate with him before, but he had gone to the country to a case overnight. He got her warning that the police suspected him of being responsible for her mistress's death, just after he carried his second victim, his uncle, in a dying condition from the garden." The detective struck a match and relit his cigar. Dr. Haley sat watching him with sorrowful eyes. 10 minutes later, as you know," he went on, "Cornwall blew his brains out. He had the wit to see that the game was up. He had been badly stung, of course, but his long experience of the bees made this a less serious matter than it would have been in the case of an ordinary outsider. In any case, moreover, he had to accept that risk if his plan was to succeed." Silence fell in the big consulting room. Then the doctor remarked,
"Miss Cornwall has recently become engaged to be married?"
Yes.
Biles drew a long whiff.
That was the circumstance which made speed essential to her cousin's murderous plan. He was hopelessly in debt. As a result of Mrs. Bardwell's extravagance, only his uncle's money, which is considerable, would have saved him. If Miss Cornwall married, he must have lost all hope of obtaining it, and so of marrying the girl on whom he had set his fickle heart. I have ascertained that he insisted on inoculating both father and daughter against spring catarrh a month ago, and that the injections he gave them hurt them terribly. No doubt Mrs. Bardwell received a similar injection about the same time. Thus, for each of these three individuals, a single bee sting, on your showing, meant instant death.
Dr. Haley inclined his head.
The moment I saw the swarm, the truth flashed across my mind, he declared. These Cyprian bees, as I have been at pains to find out, and as your beekeeping friend told you, are exceedingly ill-natured. But no bees, unless they have been previously roused to frenzy, ever attack at sight people who have not even approached their hives. It was all too clear, even in that first terrible moment, that the swarm was part of a carefully prepared plan.
The detective rose and held out his hand.
But for you, my dear friend, he said, Miss Cornwall must inevitably have shared her father's fate, and the most devilish murder of which I have ever so much as heard would almost certainly have gone unsuspected and unpunished.
Pritkin, who was born in Bladen County, North Carolina, wrote for the Charlotte News. His first book, Tory Oath, The Story of the Revolution in Bladen County, was published in 1941 and was followed by Courage, A Story of Modern Cockfighting. After moving to Tennessee, he wrote West Goes the Road, tracing early movement into that state. The following work, 18 Oak Ties, was first published in Cavalcade magazine. Incidentally, galluses, mentioned in the first paragraph, are suspenders, and tires is how the characters in the story pronounce ties. Little Bernie Langshire was 5 years old, and he had on pants. Not his pants, pants. He was not interested in them. They had more to do with Granville than with him. His ma put him in them, everyday shirt and all, like something in a bucket whenever his pa took him to Granville. Whoever went to the railroad with his pa, Jack or Pep or Bernie, wore the pants. They stayed on because they had a gallus. They were big, stiff corduroys, cut down but did not fit. But you wore them when you went to Granville. Bernie reached up to his almost white toe hair and scratched a mosquito bite. His hair was stiff and bristly, with little ridges in it where yesterday his ma, in preparation for the trip, cut it damn nigh all off. Quietly, while Nigger Mule pounded his hoofs in the grit-pomp-pomp, Bernie watched the left wheel at the front of the one-horse wagon turn over. He paid no attention to the wide scene of white sandhills, covered thinly with scrub oaks and wire grass, with a few tall longleaf pines reaching up.
His eyes sought the thing that moved most. Grit worked in between the tire and the fellow and popped. The axle was worn, and the wheel leaned first in and now out as it turned. Pa had stuffed soft soap into the hub yesterday, and the axle didn't squeak as almost always it did. When the sand rut ran with water down near the branches, the wheels made purling sounds like music. But it was a long way between branches, and Nigger Mule went so slow. Bernie twisted in his brown pants, sighed, looked up at his paw on the same seat, and smiled.
"Reckon we'll see a train?" he asked.
His paw was a gaunt, quiet man with a drooping black mustache. He wore a dark felt hat with dust caked into the brim of it. Over his faded hickory shirt, bed-ticking galluses crossed where his long back bent, to lean on his knees while he sat and drove. His paw did not answer at once, did not move, only said, "Tsh, tsh," to the Nigger Mule. Then he slowly switched his tobacco from one cheek to the other and spat over the right wheel.
"Reckon not," he drawled. "We got to go and come. Extra special business."
"Why, paw?"
Bernie wanted to see a train.
"Important business, I told you. Life and death-like. Got to hurry. Now shut up. I got things on my mind."
"Wish I could see a train," Bernie said futilely, easily, like a breeze blowing.
Almost they were at Grantville. It was a big place. It had a railroad and a depot and two stores, a big one and a little one. And the section master's house. Already they could see the station. It was a flat little building with a dull red tin roof and lead-colored paint on the sides, with brown stripes at the corners. The paint was peeling off in dry splinters. Bernie's paw drove on by the big-time store and lumbered over the railroad track toward Jerry Murdy's little store. He drove up to a tree and stopped, stepping to the ground and hitching Nigger Mule to a limb. Bernie clambered out. They spoke to Jerry on the store porch and walked toward the railroad tool house, where the section force was working. Captain Darney, the section master, was a tall, red-faced, thin man, well-dressed in clean overalls, with a big gold watch chain hung across his chest. He made a lot of money. Some said $110 a month.
"I come to see you about getting some tires, Cap'n,"
Bernie's paw told him.
"Oak ties?"
Cap'n Darney said, looking sideways, like he was listening for something bad.
"No, pine tires."
The section master shook his head. "They ain't buying none. They want oak ties." Bernie's paw's lips closed tight, and his Adam apple went up and down as if he swallowed. He didn't say anything.
"I was scared of that," he said quietly. "I don't practically never have no luck."
"How's that?" asked the captain.
"Well, it's this way. Me and Henry and Bill, we can get out pine tars all right. But if I put enough pressure on my little boiler to saw oak ties, she'll bust sure."
"I wouldn't want to be around no boiler when it busts," Cap'n Darney said. "Somebody's liable to get killed."
"That's the trouble."
"Well, maybe, after Christmas." Bernie's paw shook his head so quick that Cap'n Darney stopped talking.
"I can't wait until after Christmas. My cotton wasn't worth shucks this year, and I'm out of money. I got to scrape up some short off. My wife's in a delicate way, and some other time won't do."
"Oh, in a case like that, Dr. Reynolds'll trust you."
"No, Cap'n."
Again Bernie's paw shook his head.
"No, I ain't never asked him to trust me. I allus had the notion that if he knew the cash money was waiting, he'd come quicker and do better. That's human nature. I got a mighty fine wife, Cap'n, and I ain't taking no chances. A woman has hard enough time with everything in her favor."
"That's right," Cap'n Darney agreed.
"Wish to goodness the railroad was buying pine tars."
"Wish so. You reckon your boiler would really bust?"
"Reckon so."
"Well, maybe, after Christmas."
"Now let me see. $15 for Doc Reynolds and $7 for Granny Boyce. That's $22. How much you paying for oak ties?"
$1.25. 18 would come to $22.50. "But you ain't figuring on sawing oak ties with a weak boiler, are you?" Bernie looked up without much interest at his tall, sad paw.
He never saw a boiler burst.
No boilers he ever saw burst.
Maybe not. Maybe so. Hadn't thought much about it,
his pa said, turning back toward Nigger Mule. Bernie wondered why the section master looked after them so strangely. As they walked along the track, Bernie's pa kept looking down at the ties on which they walked.
Don't see why a train can't run on pine tars the same as oak tires, he complained.
Bernie didn't care. He was getting tired and sleepy. He yawned. His pa took off his corduroy pants at the wagon, made a pillow in the wagon bed, and it was dark when he woke up at home. The next morning, when he got up and had breakfast, he found his pa and Henry and Bill had hitched Nigger Mule to the wagon and were loading axes and saws for a trip to the woods. Bernie's ma was sitting in the doorway, her hands under her apron watching them. She was thin and blue-eyed and tired-looking, and Bernie thought her very beautiful.
"Anybody seen that piece of hay wire I had in the barn?"
his pa asked, coming up to her.
"What you want with hay wire?"
she asked suspiciously.
"You going to tie down the valve and cut oak ties?"
Bernie's pa laughed loudly. He laughed until he bent over.
"What a fool question," he declared. "Don't you know we can't saw oak tires with that boiler?" "Are you?" she asked. "Won't the railroad buy pine tars?" "Who said the railroad wouldn't buy pine tars?" he demanded. "The man," Bernie spoke up, "said he didn't want no pine tars."
"Oh," Bernie's pa said,
"you didn't hear him right."
"Don't do it. Don't you dare do it," Barney's ma said. She stood up and grasped him by the shirt. Her eyes were hard and bright. She kind of shook his paw, and her voice sounded as if she hurt. Bernie thought she was going to cry and felt angry at his paw.
"Now, Bessie,"
his paw said, speaking tenderly, taking her hands and making her sit down.
"Don't concern yourself with men's business. You got plenty to worry about without that."
He turned and went to the wagon. Henry and Bill were waiting for him. Henry was 16 and had big, wide shoulders and wore broken shoes. Bill was only 14 and was barefoot. They drove off, the wagon and the tools clattering as the wheels ran over roots in the lane. Bernie's ma sat in the doorway and looked after them. Her chin was trembling, and Bernie wondered why. That was a very poor day for Bernie. The other children, Jack and Jill and Pep and Millie, went out and played, but his mother's drawn white face continued before him, and he remained at her side. She said nothing and let him stay. An hour later they began to hear, far away, the sharp bite of axes in the trees. She gazed that way with strained eyes, and he looked at her and was troubled. He went into the front room to look at the pictures in the newspapers, which were pasted on the walls, but when he called to her to come and tell him what words spelled, she would not. That was puzzling. She always had. She liked to spell words for him, and, when she knew, tell him what they meant. More strangely still, she would not come when he called to her to tell him about the picture which hung over the fireplace. It was an old-fashioned frame, a queer man with a big plume on his hat and a sword under his cape. That, Bernie's ma always told him proudly, was his grandpa's grandpa and a great fine gentleman. Bernie did not understand that. His pa had no sword. But today his ma would not come to him and talk about the man with the plume, but sat in her splint-bottomed chair at the door and listened to the axes chopping. It became noon, and she grew angry. She left her place at the door and went to the kitchen. She built a fire in the cook stove and heated a pot of beans. When these were warm, she poured them in a dish and set it on the table so solidly it almost broke.
"Come and get it,"
she called out the door to the children, and her voice was harsh and ill-tempered. She herself ate nothing, but sat at the door and listened for the axes. Bernie ate and went back to her side. For a time there was quiet in the woods, but still his mother sat and listened and looked, as if she could see and hear every move they made. Now and then she sighed, but she never smiled. Bernie tried to make her smile by rubbing her hand over his short hair, but she pushed him away and continued to look always in the direction of his tall, sad pa, who was out there in the woods, getting out ties. Millie was a big girl of 12. She asked if she might take the twins down in the woods where her pa was.
No,
his mom snapped.
No.
All the children looked on, strangely quiet, passed around her and went out to play. But Bernie gathered to himself the grimness which wore at her heart, and sat with her, suffering and not knowing why. He yawned and slept a while. There finally came a rumbling sound from the woods, which Bernie knew was the noise from the boiler and engine, followed by the scream of the little circular saw as it bit into the first log. Bernie's ma seemed to feel that scream as something that was like a chill. She leaned forward in her chair, grasping it and holding on until her fingers were white. The wind changed and the rumble of the mill could not be heard. She sat for a long time listening and could hear nothing. Then, as the sun moved westward, she carried her little chair to the porch and sat in the shade of a clematis vine. There, whitely, she listened, and now and then could hear the whine of the saw in the hard logs. For the remainder of the day, she sat until the sun was sinking into a black cloud. A thunderstorm began to rumble, and Bernie could not say which noise was which, whether it was the storm or the sawmill which made those sharp, exploding sounds. Nor could his mother. She was afraid of storms, but when the thunder ripped through the sky, she did not move, but sat still, staring toward the woods, saying prayers in shrill, whispered words to God. Then, before long, there was a clatter down the lane, and Nigger Mule came galloping in, bumping the wagon over the roots, heading for the stable before the storm broke. Henry and Bill went to the barn, but Bernie's pa jumped to the ground and came to the house. He took Bernie's ma's hands and lifted her upright from the chair, and she took both his hands in hers and rubbed them gently. Her eyes had a sort of glow as they looked at each other, but Bernie's ma and pa never were great hands to say much. "Well, we got 'em all out. 18 good oak tires," his pa said, leading the way to the wash basin on the back porch shelf.
"I've been pretty lazy myself," his ma said. "Just sat around all day."
This brings us to the end of an hour of short stories, which originated from NTRB, North Texas Radio for the Blind, Dallas. For more about this program, visit www.anhourofshortstories.com. I'm John Pritchett. Thanks for listening.
Listening to Audio Journal, a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network.
WICN Public Radio is a proud partner of Audio Journal. Audio Journal provides news, information, and entertainment to visually and print-impaired residents of central Massachusetts. Audio Journal broadcasts are made possible through the use of a portion of WICN's broadcast frequency. 90.5 WICN is Worcester's only NPR affiliate and the voice of arts and culture in central Massachusetts. Visit WICN.org for more info.
Welcome to Everyday Poems for Every Day, sponsored by Audio Journal. Our poem today is To You by Langston Hughes. To sit and dream, to sit and read, to sit and learn about the world. Outside our world of here and now, our problem world. To dream of vast horizons of the soul through dreams made whole, unfettered, free. Help me. All you who are dreamers too, help me to make our world anew. I reach out my dreams to you. You've been listening to Everyday Poems for Every Day, sponsored by Audio Journal. Thanks for listening, and may your life be filled with poetic wonder. Oh, and this poem was read by me, Nikki Wichelow.